Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ashoka, Portrait of a Philosopher King, by Patrick Olivelle, narrated by Neil Shah. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to charts present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Abbreviations: MRE, Minor Rock Edict. MRI, Minor Rock Inscription. MPI, Minor Pillar Inscription. PE, Pillar Edict. RE, Rock Edict. SEP ED, Separate Edict. Preface. This portrait of King Ashoka is aimed principally at the informed and curious public. As such, its target audience is not the scholarly community. Although it is based on sound scholarship, I have tried to avoid scholarly jargon as much as possible. My wish is that a wide range of listeners, including scholars, may find something worthwhile and interesting in it. The 21st century has generated a renewed interest in Ashoka. Harry Falk's monumental work, Ashokan Sites and Artifacts, published in 2006, has become an indispensable resource for anyone working on Ashoka. My own interest in Ashoka developed around the same time. I organized two conferences, one in Austin, Texas in 2006, and a much larger international conference in Delhi in 2009. The latter was sponsored by the University of Texas at Austin, Jawaharlal Nehru University Center for Historical Studies, the Indian Council of Historical Research, the American Institute of Indian Studies, and the India International Center, pointing to the institutional interest in furthering research into Ashoka and his times. These conferences resulted in two volumes, Ashoka in History and Historical Memory, and Reimagining Ashoka, Memory and History. In 2012, another book on Ashoka appeared, Ashoka, The Search for India's Lost Emperor, by Charles Allen, whose focus was the 19th century discovery of Ashoka. Dilip Chakraborty's study of the geography of Ashokan edicts, Royal Messages by the Wayside, Historical Geography of the Ashokan Edicts, appeared in 2011. Nayanjot Lahiri's important biography of Ashoka, Ashoka and Ancient India, was published in 2015. Other recent works include Ashok Khanna's Ashoka the Visionary, Life, Legend, and Legacy in 2020, and a very personal rendering by Irwin Allen Seeley, Ashoka, A Sutra, in 2021. After this book was sent to press, Nayanjot Lahiri's new book, Searching for Ashoka, Questing for a Buddhist King from India to Thailand, Tracing Ashoka's Influence Across Asia, came out. And Herman Tekin's The Ashoka Inscriptions. Unfortunately, I have not been able to fully incorporate their material into this volume. Mine is the latest in this spate of books on the great emperor, and I hope it will present this sensitive and complex person in a new light, a light derived from his own words. All the translations of Ashokan inscriptions cited in the book are my own, unless otherwise stated. The full translation of the entire Ashokan inscriptional corpus is given in the appendix. I have dedicated this book to a group of forgotten individuals, the little people, whose labors are seldom recognized, stonemasons, engravers, and scribes, whose toil has preserved Ashoka's words for us to read. We know the name of only one, Chapada, whose work is found in the south using the Brahmi script, but who was a native of the Northwest, because he wrote his name in his native Kharosthi. There are others, sculptors, artists, quarry workers, engineers, and simple laborers, whose collective work created the magnificent pillars and capitals that are ascribed to Ashoka, and who go largely unrecognized. These artistic masterpieces are as much the product of these anonymous workers as they are Ashoka's. Let us spare a thought for these unsung heroes of Ashoka's legacy. Patrick Olivelle. Prologue. The Many Ashokas. Reimagining the past to imagine and thus construct the present is a deeply human trait. Our minds edit our memories. This imagining is done sometimes intentionally, but in the main unconsciously, by individuals and groups, be they social, political, or religious. Memory is complex and pliable. It is never a simple and straightforward presentation of the past, unconnected to the demands of the present. Memory both selects and suppresses features of the past and adds newly remembered features in creating a narrative that serves the needs of the present. So it was with the memory of Ashoka, the 3rd century BCE king, who ruled over a larger area of the Indian subcontinent than anyone else before British colonial rule. The fame of Ashoka spread far and wide, both in India and in other parts of Asia, a fame that prompted diverse reimaginations of the king and his significance. Such reimaginations in various strands of Buddhism and in Brahmanical Sanskrit texts, both within India and in regions of South, Southeast, Central, and East Asia, produced many Ashokas. In a seminal remark, the historian Robert Lingat notes, "There are in reality 2 Ashokas, the historical Ashoka whom we know through his inscriptions, and the legendary Ashoka, who is known to us through texts of diverse origins, Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese, and Tibetan." Although essentially correct, there are 2 problems with Lingat's assessment. First, it is simplistic to contrast the historical with the legendary. The portrait of Ashoka I have constructed in this book is based on Ashokan inscriptions and artifacts, yet it contains a heavy dose of interpretation, translation, imagination, narrative, perhaps bias, and within the constraints of my own abilities, even artistry. Others using these same sources would have, and indeed have, written different biographical narratives. The legendary is not simply false and to be dismissed. It is the reimagination of the past to serve present needs, something inherently human. These narratives were meaningful and important to the persons and communities that constructed them. Their purpose was not to do history in the modern sense of the term, but to do something that was much more significant to them in their own time. The second issue with Lingat's remark is that it posits a dichotomy. There are actually not 2, but several Ashokas, including modern ones. Just as the ancient Ramayana narrative has been appropriated, reimagined, and retold in different languages in different parts of India and Asia, so Ashoka has been narratively appropriated and reappropriated at different times by different peoples. That is the legacy of Ashoka. I will turn to that legacy at the end of my narrative. Briefly, though, there are at least 3 major strands of the Ashokan story in ancient South Asia. The first was constructed by Sri Lankan Buddhist chroniclers spanning the first 500 years of the Common Era in the Dipavansa and the Mahavansa, written in Pali. The theme around which this narrative is woven is the legitimation of Sri Lankan Buddhism of the Theravada tradition by establishing strong historical connections to Ashoka. He is credited with bringing Buddhism to Sri Lanka by sending his own son, Mahinda, and daughter, Sanghamitta, as missionaries, as well as a sapling from the Bodhi tree under which the Buddha gained enlightenment. He is also credited with holding a Buddhist council in Pataliputra to purge Buddhism of deviant doctrines and practices and to restore the pure and pristine form of Buddhism, which happens to be the doctrine of the elders, the Theravada, that took root in Sri Lanka. The second strand is found in texts of the northern Buddhist traditions written principally in Sanskrit. Its best constructed narrative is the Ashokavardhana, composed around the 2nd century CE and translated into Chinese in 300 CE. This biography of Ashoka exerted a strong influence on the Ashokan traditions in Central and East Asian countries. It is, however, silent on the 2 prominent features of the Sri Lankan chronicles, the 3rd Council of Pataliputra and the bringing of Buddhism to Sri Lanka by Ashoka's children. Nevertheless, they both share the vision of Ashoka as the fulfillment and capstone of the Buddha's mission. Thus, the famous epic poem on the Buddha's life, the Buddha Charita, written by the monk Ashwagosha in the 2nd century CE, ends not with the death of the Buddha, but with Ashoka's construction of over 80,000 stupas across the Indian landscape, in all of which the Buddha's ashes were entombed. This triumphalist construction project is presented as the final victory of Buddhism in the land of its birth. The third narrative, if it can be called a narrative at all, given the lack of detail, is found in later Brahmanical sources, especially in the Puranas. As opposed to the idealized portrayal of Ashoka in the various Buddhist narratives, the Puranic version is bare bone. The Matsya Purana version, for example, simply states that Kautilya will anoint Chandragupta as king, and he will be succeeded by Ashoka, who will reign for 36 years. There are also the unarticulated versions of the Ashokan story that occur both in Brahmanical Sanskrit literature as well as in some Buddhist traditions of kingship, what the Buddhist scholar Max Deg has called the model ruler without a name. Scholars have noted that the subtext behind many major Brahmanical writings, including the Mahabharata and the Law Book of Manu, is the Ashokan social and political reforms, which challenged the centrality of Brahmins within the social structure and political ideology, what has been called Brahmanical exceptionalism. Ashoka, however, is never mentioned in them by name. These Brahmanical texts presented arguments and constructed narratives to support Brahmanical exceptionalism, the epic heroes Rama and Yudhishthira being Brahmanical counterpoints to the Buddhist Ashoka. These narrative reimaginations of Ashoka were carried out purely through historical memory and fertile imagination. The narrators had little or no access to Ashoka's inscriptional and architectural remains. They could not read the messages Ashoka had left for posterity in the many rock and pillar inscriptions written in a script that they could no longer decipher. But the memory of Ashoka's connection to the inscriptions and the pillars appears to have continued. The Chinese pilgrim Fa Jian, for example, traveling in India around 400 CE, came to Sankasa and saw there a pillar shining bright as lapis lazuli with a lion on top. The locals informed him that it was erected by Ashoka, but Ashoka's words remained silent. All this changed in 1837. That was the year James Prinsep, a British colonial officer posted to India, succeeded in deciphering the Brahmi script in which most of the Ashokan inscriptions were written. The ability to read and understand the very words of Ashoka created a new Ashoka, the inscriptional Ashoka. Prior to that year, all we had were the Buddhist hagiographical Ashokas and the Brahmanical antagonistic Ashokas. The modern scholarly construction of this inscriptional Ashoka, however, was not easy or straightforward. Some of the inscriptions had sustained damage over the 2 millennia they stood in the open, exposed to rain, sun, and wind. Others posed linguistic challenges to reading and understanding. There may have also been errors introduced by the scribes and engravers who mediated between Ashoka's messages and their inscribed forms we possess. Yet, in spite of all the difficulties, this is the precious gift of Ashoka. He has bequeathed to us his very words, something quite rare in the ancient historical record. There have been, and there continue to be, scholarly debates and disagreements about both the readings and the meanings of Ashokan inscriptions, as well as about their overall significance for the life and message of Ashoka and his imperial project. I will have occasion to refer to them throughout this book, as also in my translations of the inscriptions given in the appendix. In his exhaustive Ashokan bibliography published in 2006, the historian Harry Falk lists around 1,600 books and articles on Ashoka that have appeared in print over the past century or so. Many more have been written since then. The scholar of epigraphy Richard Solomon offers a word of caution. Despite having been intensively studied for over a century and a half, the Ashokan inscriptions remain problematic in several respects, and many points of interpretation are still controversial. So, even with the access we have today to the very words of Ashoka, there have emerged many inscriptional Ashokas, not as divergent as the pre-inscriptional Ashokas, but nevertheless containing significant differences. One other significant ramification of the new inscriptional Ashoka was his adoption by the Indian Freedom Movement, spearheaded by Jawaharlal Nehru, for whom Ashoka provided raw material for his nation-building project. The peace-loving emperor who unified India over 2 millennia ago and left his words of wisdom for future generations indelibly written on stone, he thought, could serve as a model for the nascent nation, for the new India dedicated to peace and prosperity. This can be called the nationalist Ashoka, if we remove the pejorative connotations from the term nationalist. As new nations are created, the United States of America and the modern nation-state of India are examples, the nation-building process demands national heroes and mythic narratives. The United States had the Revolutionary War, the Founding Fathers, and the written Constitution. As the newly independent India looked for past heroic and exemplary figures, Ashoka and Ashokan artifacts became an obvious choice. Ashokan emblems decorate the major symbols of the modern Indian state. The wheel, at once the wheel of the war chariot of the world conqueror, Chakravartin, and the wheel of Dharma set in motion by the Buddha, occupies the center of the Indian flag. The lion capital that stood atop the Ashokan pillar at Sarnath, where the Buddha preached his first sermon containing the Four Noble Truths, now adorns Indian currency and state emblems. Ashoka also penetrated the consciousness of the Indian populace. This can be seen in the large number of boys who were and are being named Ashok, a name that was rare before the 20th century. When prominent Indian entrepreneurs wanted to found an Ivy League kind of institution of higher education in India in 2014, they called it Ashoka University. We also have a television adaptation called Chakravartin Ashoka Samrat, and Ashoka is featured in the well-known illustrated biographical series by Amar Chitrakatha. The name has become so paradigmatically Indian, even in the diaspora, that a major character in the popular American comic strip, Dilbert, is an Indian expat named Ashok, an intern who is a brilliant graduate from the Indian Institute of Technology, the stereotype of the cerebral Indian in popular American culture, and first Indian comic character to win hearts globally. The inscriptional Ashoka has a deep impact also on world historians of the early 20th century, given how unique his message was among the great rulers of the past. The excitement among them is captured by H.G. Wells in his Outline of History. Amidst the tens of thousands of names of monarchs that crowd the columns of history, their majesties and graciousnesses and serenities and royal highnesses and the like, the name of Ashoka shines, and shines almost alone, a star. More living men cherish his memory today than have ever heard the names of Constantine or Charlemagne. There has been, however, a tendency among scholars writing on Ashoka, especially those writing biographies of him, to blend deliberately or unconsciously the two Ashokas, borrowing interesting details of the king's life from his hagiographies when they needed to flesh out the meager information found in Ashoka's own inscriptions. Even Nayanjot Lahiri's recent biography, Ashoka in Ancient India, admirable in many respects, is not immune to this pitfall. The eminent historian of ancient India, Romila Thapar, warned against this over half a century ago. Buddhist sources from Ceylon, Sri Lanka, Tibet, and China contain fairly detailed accounts of his life. The Ashokan edicts were therefore interpreted on the basis of information provided by these sources. It is indeed unfortunate that in reconstructing his life and activities, these and other religious sources were regarded as reliable and complementary evidence to that of his own inscriptions. I will heed her warning. So, in the following chapters, I too will be engaged in creating a new Ashoka, following the footsteps, though not the methods, of many modern biographers, beginning with the British historian Vincent Smith in 1901. One may question, however, whether a biography in the full sense of the term is even possible in the case of Ashoka. I think not. There is such a dearth of reliable information about his life and activities. We do not even know for sure when he was born, when he ascended to the throne, or when he died, or for that matter, his true name. Writing about Alexander of Macedonia, who lived two generations before Ashoka and was a contemporary of his grandfather, Chandragupta, the historian Robin Lane Fox concludes that it is impossible to write a biography of that Greek emperor because we do not have sufficient authentic material on his life. Augustine, Cicero, and perhaps the emperor Julian, Fox asserts, are the only figures from Greco-Roman antiquity whose biography can be attempted, and Alexander is not among them. He calls his book on Alexander a search, not a story. We are both better off and worse off in the case of Ashoka. Worse off because, as opposed to Alexander, histories of whose life and exploits were written based on more than 20 accounts authored by his contemporaries, there is not a single account of Ashoka written by his contemporaries, and no historical biographies, except for the Buddhist hagiographies written at least 300 years later. Ashoka's chancery had no chroniclers, or, if there were, their work had been lost without a trace. Better off, because we can hear Ashoka's own voice speaking in his numerous inscriptions, something we do not have for Alexander. Mine, then, will not be a conventional biography, but more a portrait of the man as it emerges from his own writings and from the art and architecture he pioneered. It will be, in Fox's words, a search, not a story. The hope is that others will carry forward this search, which may lead to further insights and discoveries relating to this unique figure in world history. I will refer to the Buddhist hagiographies and other ancient Indian writings, such as Kautilya's Arthashastra, all of them post-dating Ashoka by several centuries, only in passing when they throw some light on the inscriptional evidence and its social and historical background. Nevertheless, we need further historical information not available from the inscriptions themselves in order to put them into context and understand them within their contemporary historical context. For this, I will use non-inscriptional sources, especially Greek sources, such as the surviving fragments of the book by Megasthenes, the Seleucid envoy to Chandragupta's court in Pataliputra, bearing on the Maurya rulers. Historical reconstruction is always an approximation. One can never reach certainty. We have to deal with the possible, the plausible, and hopefully the probable in envisaging that background. At the end of it, we will have to acknowledge that this is the best we can do. The old scholastic philosophers of medieval Europe had a wise saying, Qui nimis probat nihil probat. Who proves too much, proves nothing. Too much certainty where certainty is wanting undermines historical writings. When it comes to Ashoka, certainty is a rare commodity. We do not need the certainty and hyperbole of the hagiographers, however, to perceive the unique personality of Ashoka. H.G. Wells is right to consider him unique, shining, almost alone among ancient or even modern rulers. I refrain from calling him great or the greatest, terms that are much abused these days and have lost their value. I call him unique because he is singular. There is no one remotely like him in world history. He stands alone. He was not just a king with strong religious convictions, but a king who was deeply introspective, a person who, as Richard Solomon once remarked, was perhaps the lone king in world history who was strong enough to say, I'm sorry. Ashoka wanted not only to rule his territory, but also to give it a unity of purpose and aspiration, to unify the people of his vast and heterogeneous empire, not by a cult of personality, as numerous kings of antiquity did, often by claiming divine status, but by the cult of an idea, a moral idea, encapsulated in the term dharma, serving as the linchpin of a new moral order. He aspired to forge a new moral philosophy that would be internalized not only by the people of his empire, but also by rulers and subjects of other countries, through an ambitious program of mass moral education. He was attempting to forge a universal moral philosophy that can underpin a theory of international relations where practicing dharma can bring, or so he thought, international conflicts to an end. Indeed, some major modern political philosophers have attempted to mine the ideas of Ashoka to build a modern non-Western theory of international relations. This is the world of Ashoka, a new and hopefully a bit more adequate rendition of the inscriptional Ashoka, that I invite the listener to enter and to discover, to savor this unique and complex personality, and through his eyes, to gain a new perspective of India in the 3rd century before the Common Era. Ashoka by any other name. What is the name of Ashoka? Asked that way, it is a tautology. The answer is contained in the question. We could ask instead, what is the name of the Indian king who wrote the inscriptions and erected the inscribed pillars in the 3rd century BCE? Asked that way, the answer is not obvious or clear. The following discussion is a bit technical, and I beg the listener's indulgence. Several of Ashoka's inscriptions contain the three-word title, the Beloved of Gods, King Piyadasi, Devanampiye Piyadasi Laja, or an abbreviation of it. In all of Indian literature, the epithet Beloved of Gods, used self-referentially by Ashoka, as already noted, is found for the first time in Ashoka's inscriptions. The consensus is that it is a royal title. Scholars, therefore, often translate it non-literally as His Majesty. That it was an honorific title is beyond doubt. In Rock Edict 8, Ashoka refers to former kings also with this title, indicating that he viewed it as a generic designation of his royal predecessors. Ashoka's grandson, Dasharath, left behind 3 inscriptions in which he used it as his own title. Yet in later Sanskrit usage, Devanampriya is used for mockery, generally indicating that the person so addressed is a fool. The historian Harmut Scharfa has suggested that this Indian expression may have derived from a parallel Greek one, Friend of the King, which was an honorific title that Hellenistic kings bestowed on subordinate rulers owing them allegiance. The Greek historian Grant Parker, however, has noted that this Greek expression does not appear in inscriptions, and it is highly unlikely that the Mauryan rulers considered themselves in any way inferior or owing allegiance to the Western Hellenistic kings. The linguist Madhav Deshpande, furthermore, has shown numerous Vedic precedents to this expression. We must acknowledge, though, that this is a rather curious and unique appellation, which did not last too long after the Mauryas, becoming an expression used in jest or sarcastically. I will discuss the second term, Piyadasi, Sanskrit Priyadarshin, presently. It was probably the personal name of the king. Some inscriptions shorten the title, omitting one of the first 2 terms. The name Ashoka, however, is nowhere to be found, except in 4 isolated cases. If we had only the inscriptions and not the later Buddhist hagiographies and Puranic accounts, we may well have called him Piyadasi, and the title of the present book would have carried that name. So where does the name Ashoka come from? In Ashoka's inscriptional corpus, it is found 4 times in a cluster of minor rock edicts in the south, what is today Karnataka, twice in Minor Rock Edict 1 and twice in Minor Rock Edict 2. Most versions of the Minor Rock Edict carry only the title Beloved of Gods. These 4 outliers appear to have been inscribed later by scribes or patrons who wanted to connect the name Ashoka to these inscriptions. They also contained other modifications to the original wording of these edicts. We see that the 2 at Muski and Gujara give the name of the king in the genitive, Devanam Piyasa Ashokasa, meaning that what follows is the message of the Beloved of Gods of Ashoka, while all others, and more original versions are in the nominative. Devanam piye hevam aha.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?